Well, tell me about that then. Maybe let's imagine we're coming off of a little sample of On the Turning Away, and how was this track significant, and how did the idea become sparked, and where'd you go from there? Maybe early days of the idea for the project.
You want to take that one, Damon, or you?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, Turning was definitely in there, and then I think that was kind of the beginning stage of. It was just listening to Floyd tracks again and realizing this, you know, sounds and feels very much like folk music. When if you kind of strip away, you know, some of the production, and it, you know, literally is just playing the tune on acoustic, distracted by email and morning coffee, just hearing the chords and the melody, it very much had that folk sound, yeah. Basically. And so that was kind of part of it, I think, too. And just having, you know, Celtic music in and around as arrangements, different, you know, styles and genres that I either produced or played in the past. Just to me, the Celtic lent a bit more toward the emotion that I think a lot of the Floyd songs would have eventually for us. And just really getting interested in the arrangements of trying to do that. And it was quite, quite random, quite frankly, just picking that song. It was like literally morning coffee, checking emails, like, oh, I haven't heard this song in a while, and pulled up the chords and the lyric sheet online. And it was kind of like half looking at that, half answering emails. It was like, wow, this is a good song.
Yeah. I mean, it is a great song all on its own, of course, but, I don't know, for me personally, I never would have thought to bring Pink Floyd and Celtic music together. And so it's an interesting observation to be like, oh, this sounds very much like folk music. What was that, Patrick?
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, I noticed there a little while ago, Dave Gilmour and his daughter Romany have a group together now, and she plays harp, and it's like, you know, there's videos of them playing in little local pubs and stuff. Just like we would have done back in the day, kind of thing, and still do, you know. But it's, you know, that they're rediscovering in a way their Celtic roots, or, you know, that sort of in going delving deeper into that side of things, you know, more so.
So maybe there are a lot of connection points here upon further observation. It even brings to mind, maybe this is like only a really loose connection. Maybe it's not even worth bringing up, but I think it was Roger Waters who said something once that was something like, if you had the luck of the Irish, you'd wish you were dead.
Yeah.
not that Irish is the only, not that Ireland's the only place to find Celtic music either, you know, but just, you know,
it is interesting. Like the Irish haven't had great luck over the years as far historically or in the larger sense of things, but it is nice being an Irish person in another country or traveling and that kind of things is always a warm welcome. People are always like, oh, you're Irish. Woo-hoo.
Will you sing me a song? Is that the first request? You
know, yeah. Yeah. Let's all get drunk. I don't know what it is, but it's like, you know.
Are you drunk now?
Yeah.
well, from On the Turning Away, have you found as you've been going through this project, do any of these tracks stand out to you guys as like having fit particularly well, like, oh, this is like really in the pocket of folk music, like this is a natural fit? Do any come to mind when you're thinking like really easy fits?
I think just really quick, I'll jump in, and you guys I'm sure have different ideas on this too, but it's not so much the folk part, but Brick in the Wall for us, I think, just being able to start with this kind of military snare, the drones. I think that when we played that live, I think that's when everybody was like,
we don't need no phone control.
What? Mm. What is this? What's going on?
Don't sarcasm in the classroom.
Kind of entered the arena of, oh, you can do that.
Teacher, leave the kids alone. Leave
folk versus the rock. So it's not even that. It's just
it wasn't
so much the folk thing. It was like, if we kind of touch on, and hopefully all of them, but you know, some probably more successful than others, if we can touch on an arrangement that's like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. It's not, you know, offensive to
either group, right?
We did have a couple of, I don't know if they were real. It's like, I kind of want to print, you know, the one or two people that complain. Yeah.
Frame those.
It was like a review. Like how dare you?
I'd imagine that you'd have somebody on the one side saying, how dare you? This folk music, this trad music is sacred. And people on the other side saying, how dare you? Pink Floyd is sacred, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very few, but it's been kind of fun just to see a couple of these over the last decade. But yeah, I would say Brick in the Wall for me. And then, you know, Pat, I'm sure, and Brian, you might have others that...
Like, that's one of the things I love, is taking these songs and then finding a tune that works
in
whatever key the song is in. So, you know, I can't remember really what song it was, but or what tune it was, but just picking that tune, making it work in the context of a Pink Floyd song.
Right.
And like that, just, you know, it's a great buzz just making that work.
Yeah.
You know, to coin a phrase.
A great buzz. Great buzz. Right. That's one of my favorite things about listening to the tracks you guys have put out already, is finding the traditional tune melodies that are woven in here and there, you know, and being like, hey, on a sec, I've heard that was Dunmore Lasses, you know, like, wait a second, I've heard that before.
Exactly.
And it fits so well is the thing. It's not forced. It comes out so naturally.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's all music, you know? Yeah.
Brian, did any stand out to you as having been like a particularly good fit?
The thing that I've come to appreciate is, having started this project, then going back and listening to the original Floyd stuff, I hear Celtic influences that I never realized were there before. So just in general, it kind of strikes me how there was this stuff that was right there and, you know, we never really realized it until now. So,
well, if I may ask you about a specific track then, because there are a couple that, for me at least, like, if the first time that I came across the group and started looking down the list, like, it's not, I'm not saying that like Brick in the Wall is obvious, like not in a derogatory or mean way, but like that's obviously like a very big Pink Floyd song. And so it's like, well, if anybody's going to cover any Floyd, that's going to be pretty close to the top of the list of options, right? But you have a few, like Have a Cigar, where I'm like, if I'd made a list, that would have been at the bottom of the list of like likely candidates, you know? And yet it works really well. I think the way you guys do it is awesome. And so I'm curious about that track in particular, and any others that are like on the other end of the spectrum, you were surprised you could make them work, or maybe took extra work in order to make it work.
I think with Cigar, Brian, you could probably speak to that one more, especially because of that middle part.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I actually came up with the arrangement for Cigar, and it just started with, I had that guitar part pop into my head, and I thought, oh, this is something totally different from what the song originally was, but I think it would work. Mm-hmm. And so then I started messing around and demoing it, and... the one thing that was kind of funny is I put what I thought was just going to be a placeholder fiddle solo, because, you know, I wanted the real talent to take care of doing the solo. Mm-hmm. And So I put this in, and everyone was like, oh, that's so great. What is it? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just some little placeholder thing I threw down, and it ended up making the album. So
what a happy
just
accident.
Never know what's going to happen. Right, exactly.
Read something, maybe it was that same article, got on the streaming services, if I'm not mistaken. There's basically two albums. There's like the in studio album, and then there's the other is like, is the other, is the other one like a live in studio situation?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the original album from 2011, that was kind of like everything in the kitchen sink. We had, you know, phenomenal players. There is quite, I don't know, 12 people maybe totally. A lot of really great folks came out of that. And then the in studio was, you know, when we're trying to do kind of more of a live type of thing. And we're like, well, it's, we needed to demo some stuff. So we cobbled together a couple of new ones as well. And then it, subsequently we've had a few singles and I think that's kind of where we're at now is maybe just kind of releasing some singles here and there.
What I was thinking of was that it's one of those, probably the first of the two. What I'd read was that like it was initially meant to be like basically like a rehearsal album, like something I'd imagine that you could hand to a musician who's going to join you on stage in a couple weeks and be like, play along with this and you'll be ready. But then it's like, it's pretty much release ready, you know, like, and I listened to it as an album, as a finished album, you know, so those happy accidents maybe confirm that what you're doing, you're on the right track, you know.
We were kind of inspired around that time. So many artists were releasing soundboard recordings. And so we thought, you know, this would be cool. People come see us play live and then they get a recording of what they just heard. So,
yeah, that is a cool idea for sure. Yeah. Well, and speaking of all the talent that you've pulled in on the project in the past too, what has that process been like? Like, has it been any kind of challenge to like convince artists to hop in and help with the project, or are people generally pretty darn enthusiastic? I'd imagine there's at least some, you know, on the Venn diagram, Pink Floyd is popular enough and, you know, British Isles folk music is popular enough. There's got to be I'd imagine a decent sampling of people who are already familiar with both and happy to hop in.
Yeah, I would say so. Pat, you know, when we first met, I think I came see you on tour for one of the shows you were doing. And so meeting you, I think you were... You're pretty on board right away. I mean, like, who are you?
Well,
and why are you asking me about this?
Yeah, tell me about
why
that.
Why are you being so friendly?
Tell us about that from your angle, Pat. What was that like? Yeah, you finish a show, a dude you've never met before walks up and says, like, what, will you join my band? Like, what was that like?
Well, that's the first rule of being a musician. You always say yes, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, of course I will. And then, you know, things don't work out half the time, but then sometimes they do. And this is one of those happy accidents, like we've been saying. But it's like, it's the thing of, you know, I grew up playing guitar, as you can see from my wall behind. I've got a few hanging on my wall. Beautiful art, if nothing else. I don't play them very much these days, but I you know, I played all these songs in my bedroom on the guitar for all my teenage years, you know, and just love all this music, you know, just all the classic rock and roll, particularly Pink Floyd. And, you know, yeah, I could go on, but Pink Floyd was way up there on my list of favorite bands. So taking those solos and putting them, or being able to integrate jigs and reels and things into these songs was, it's just so much fun and so cool to play, like, you know, comfortably numb solo, you know, not on a Strat, but on my Illan pipes is pretty great. Like,
you know, do you have a Blackwoods chanter for your Illan pipes? You know, instead of the famous David Gilmour Black Strat, you can be like, this is the Patrick D'Arcy Black chanter, you know?
I should do that, yeah.
That's now. Yeah.
There's dozens and dozens of dollars to be made from that, you know? Yeah.
Well, if you don't mind, actually, Pat, I'd love to hear you go on just a little bit more about that. And, you know, where we're a group, I don't want to force, you know, I'd imagine we'll all enjoy listening to each other, though, but I'd like to know just a little bit of, like, further back from each of you. And I suppose, as you know, Damon and Brian, maybe your stories will intertwine quite a lot, but like, you know, you're playing guitar as a teenager, Patrick. Like, at what point did like, were you Illan pipes and penny whistle from a baby? Like, was that handed to you by your parents, or like,
what was
your music journey like to get you to where you are right now?
It was, you know, like, there was music in the house, but not traditional Irish music at all. But both my mom knew a lot of traditional Irish songs. You know, she'd sing at parties, and my dad as well. But he was more of a, like, an entertainer type singer, you know, but never professional or anything. But he was the guy who'd get up and sing at a wedding, and they'd have to drag him off the stage.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I gotcha.
You know, but just a great character. Mm. And so, but he also, like, he was always told the story about having a melodeon when he was a kid, a button accordion, and he, but it disappeared when he moved away from home, kind of thing. And then I had the opportunity to buy one over here. He was a black melodeon with a red bellows. He used to go on about, you know. So I ended up, I found one and I sent it over to him, and that was great because he picked it up immediately and was playing traditional Irish tunes. And I was just like, what in the world? Like you know 50 years later, after not, you know, of not playing,
like,
know?
Riding a bike,
so
is still
we
in.
Were so yeah so we ended up being able to play some tunes together, which was really
yeah
nice.
That's
so
awesome.
So but there was that, and then, you know, but just rock guitar and you know, all that kind of thing. And Neil Young, I loved his stuff too, on acoustic. And then I moved to LA when I was 21 in California. And then I have to say California, because here I live in Tennessee now, and you say LA and people are like, oh, Lower Alabama or Louisiana or whatever.
Sure.
You know? It's like, no. A little
bit
different.
Very different thing, yeah.
But yeah.
So but then where did Illan pipes come in for you?
Well, that was, I joined an Irish punk band right away, just after getting to America.
Pretty much.
It was like about 3 months after I arrived in America. Yeah. I was going to see this band called the Dave King Band in a place called Molly Malone's on Fairfax in Hollywood, just down the road from where Damon lives now. Damon's.
Damon, right. Yes. That's right.
No.
He's going to kill me. He's going to kill me with that. But he, this nice little Irish pub. It was like a community center for Irish immigrants in LA. You know, people could go there and get work. So I was going there, and I got some construction work through there, and you could go there and cash your check behind the bar and all that kind of thing. Obviously making millions of dollars, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, but the, but there was this band, the Dave King Band, I was going to see regularly, and they were looking for a mandolin player. So, they asked me, and I was like, of course I play the mandolin, you know, doesn't everybody, kind of thing. It's just like, I never touched a mandolin in my life.
You said so yes, and then went and bought one right after.
Yeah, exactly. You always say yes and then figure it out. You know? And that's it. You know, so went down to McCabe's guitar shop down on Pico in Santa Monica and found a mandolin I thought was a decent one. It was an old Harmony, and it served its purpose. And I was playing that in the band for 3 years. And then through that whole journey, I wanted to learn better mandolin music to improve my playing. So I discovered a band called Plankstein.
Oh, sure.
Who had amazing, you know, Andy Irvine and Don Maloney playing mandolins and bouzoukis and all this type of thing. And Christy Moore singing and playing the Bowron. And then Liam O'Flynn playing the Illan pipes and the whistles. So once I heard the Illan pipes, that just sent my life off on a complete tangent.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, I had to know everything about the Illan pipes and, you know, try and find a set, which was a whole other rigmarole.
I'm sure, yeah.
And, you know, so, yeah, so that's where that was. But that band, incidentally, became Flogging Molly was the name of
it. No, really?
Yes, because it was the Dave King Band. We were playing every Monday night for 3 years in Molly Malone's, so we were flogging a dead horse. It felt like so. It was Flogging Molly.
Played with Flogging Molly before they were Flogging Molly. We might even say that you
and while they were Flogging Molly too.
We might even say that you made them what they are. We might even say that.
Oh, absolutely.
We should say
absolutely.
That, shouldn't we?
Thank God you got out of that.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's how you say. If I was still in the band, I'd be dead. You know.
Right. Isn't their whole was it just T-shirts or was it an album cover as well that was a skeleton playing the pipes? You could say like that was modeled after me.
Exactly. That's AI of what I should look like now.
Yeah.
Well,
actual stock photo.
Yeah, that's right. Pat Darcy. Well, Brian, I want to ask you kind of the same question. Like, how did music first come into your life, and how did it carry you to where you are now? Like, what set you on the trajectory to land you here today? You know,
I think initially Damon and I had a very similar story. Growing up, my mom would always play the piano, and so she wanted that for both of us. And so, at age 3, she found a lady right down the street that gave lessons and. So,
Which was violin, though.
Well, yeah, I don't know if this is true. I've always wondered this, if because violin was her main instrument or not that she taught, but she said, I think you should be able to read before you can learn piano, which kind of makes sense, I guess. But she said that, you know, you could start off on violin right now. And so she taught via the Suzuki method, which is, it's totally ear based where they play a little passage and then you play it back. And to be honest, I didn't appreciate it at the time, but it's really shaped my whole musical career to have that ability to just hear something and then be able to play it. It's something that's really, really helped me out.
Yeah.
So anyways, at age 3, we started playing violin, and then age 5 or 6, somewhere around there, then we started playing piano. And, so progressing and getting more advanced. And so by the time that, at least for myself, when I was in high school, I was playing really intense classical stuff on piano. I was taking private lessons from someone in the University of Michigan music department on violin. And so just music was such a huge part of my life. And then... it all kind of went downhill one day when I heard the sounds of Van Halen on the radio, and it just kind of changed my life. And I'm like, wait,
forget
piano. I want to play
That's
electric guitar. So, so I wanted an electric guitar, but my parents said, well, we'll get you an acoustic and see, you know, if you stick with it. And so I just took off, and using my ear training, I learned every song I could find. And then after about a year or so of playing nonstop, my folks did end up getting me a gold top Les Paul, which I still have, and then a little tiny practice amp. And so from there on, which that was like mid high school, I've been in bands ever since then, all different kind of styles of music. But it's just, I guess the only regret I have is I kind of let violin and piano go and just focus more on guitar, and I wish I would have stuck more with it. Yeah. But you know, what can you do?
No, I understand that. Yeah.
I was gonna say Eruption must have sounded really interesting on that
on the acoustic guitar. Yeah,
it did.
It'd be like those videos, you know, that
right.
He did the lullaby version of Eruption. Yeah,
right.
Well, Damon, I'd love to, like, same question to you. I would like to stick in here real quick, though. I'm gonna go have an existential crisis after this because I just did some Googling because it didn't feel right, and I realized, of course, just in case I've confused anybody listening, I was imagining the skeleton from Dropkick Murphys. They're the ones who had this. So there you go.
Oh, glory.
Now I'll go question, like, who am I? Who even am I?
There'll be riots in the streets of Boston because of that.
Yeah. But Damon, what about you? How did music come into your life and throw you toward where you're at right now?
It was, you know, same as Brian, obviously, just growing up in the same household. Music, it was kind of a very eclectic. I mean, we had classical, as Brian mentioned, but I mean, I remember growing up listening to ABBA and Elton John, and you know, there's a lot of type of music in the household. So basically, yeah, same thing. 3 years old, violin lessons. 7 years old, piano lessons. And then, you know, segue to the marching band.
Kind of That's right. High school. I thought I remembered reading something about one or both of you doing brass at some point.
Yeah, Brian played, what, French horn?
French horn, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and I played trombone. And then we actually toured. I think, Brian, you did one, and I did two. But there was that Blue Lake camp in Michigan that had an international program. And so I think 14 years old and then 15 years old is when I went. But it's basically like a music camp, and you tour in Germany. So you're there for 2 weeks, I think, at the camp, and then you tour for 2 weeks in Bavaria and then in and around. But it was great. It's, you know, all types of genres of music. Mm. That was kind of classical as well as kind of band music as well.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No.
I was just going to ask you, at what point Van Halen ruined your trajectory?
Van Halen ruined my trajectory. Like an intervention group.
Well, was it Van Halen for you, or was it more like the Pixies and stuff like that?
So Brian definitely went to like Ozzy, Van Halen, all that stuff, which I liked. I think since we're a couple years apart, it just didn't have the same. It didn't click the same for me. I got it, but for me, I went a bit more toward like the Police.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then, you know, some poppier stuff like Duran Duran and like Pet Sounds Pixies and stuff. So it was all this kind of eclectic. And I think also just kind of segueing back a bit for arrangement with the CPF projects, it really. I don't know. It's kind of a cliche thing, but a good song is a good song. Yeah. So if you can kind of hear through like, I don't really like lab guitars, or I don't really like whatever. Okay. That's valid. But at the same time, do you like the song? Mm. And I think a lot of the times people can get kind of stuck in the production of it or the arrangement of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far as, and then past that, bass guitar, that was self-taught. That was, again, Police. I think I was borrowing Brian's acoustic or one of your older acoustics and just playing the first, you know, top four strings. Went through a lot of albums that way. And then, you know, segued into Berklee in Boston, going there and stuff like that, like music school after that.
I don't have like scientific data to back this up, but I have like a hunch and suspicion that In competitive bagpipe bands, it tends to be the case, I think, that if multiple siblings are going to play in a band, the oldest always plays pipes and the next always plays drums. It's just the way it seems to go. And I feel like there's the same thing going on in what we might call like rock generally, right? The oldest tends to play lead guitar. And the next one tends to play bass or drums. You got two options, right? Like it just seems so rare that it goes any other way.
You got to fill out you got to create that family band, you know?
Yep, and that's the order it happens in.
Well, I think too, for me with bass, you know, because I was 15, I mean, this is the instrument that I chose, and it just made sense, was there was, and especially with like playing through the Police albums, that was kind of my learning process of, you know, staying obviously, but hearing what Stuart was doing, hearing what Andy was doing as a trio. And so that kind of always really stuck in my head, is like these power trios like Rush or whoever. What can you do, you know, as this trio? How are you bouncing off of each other with arrangements? And each instrument is not stepping on the other one, and it's lending to it.
Yeah. So with arranging music in general, and I'd invite any of you to hop in on this, I'm under the impression, looking at things like IMDb and stuff like that, and Patrick, I've been a fan of Wallop the Spot, your album Wallop the Spot, since it came out. I don't remember if it was a little time lag before I had personally come to it, but just, you know, like you've all been doing music, and so when it comes to arranging for Celtic Pink Floyd in particular, like I know that you guys have credits elsewhere, you know, doing like film stuff and things like that too. Is this a different process for this group specifically than in your other projects, or does it feel very much the same as like a one? Is it Brian, is it you that has a Christmas program that you run pretty regularly as well? Sorry, I'm all over the place. All I'm saying is, like, there are these other programs that you do, these other projects, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And does Celtic Pink Floyd differ from that?
Pat's the one that has the Christmas show.
Patrick, are you the one with the Christmas show? Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to mix everybody up. I've been preparing intensely. It's all a soup in my brain now.
trying to make music a living kind of thing, you know. So I teach primarily, you know, so I have students. They're all online, but I teach Highland Pipes. Mm. And if anyone's interested out there, you know, lots of Highland Pipers, actually, they've gotten the Fred Morrison McCallum sets of Highland Pipes that are very reasonably, as far as these things go, price and all that. And they're very nicely made and everything and work well. But lots of Highland Pipers that have crossed over to the dark
side. To the dark side, yeah.
You know? And teaching. And then I play in a band called the Celts, and we do a Christmas tour, and we do a St. Patrick's Day tour and play a few festivals and stuff as well. But so you're always looking out for opportunities and things, you know.
And
kind of saying yes.
Yeah, saying yes to everything, right?
In
all of that, like everything that you're doing on the daily and on the annual, et cetera, I guess I wouldn't want to put you in a position where you have to say something like, well, Celtic Pink Floyd is basically the same as everything else and make it seem like it's not special. Like, it's still special, you know, but...
Oh, it's totally special. That's the thing. Every project is special. And then, you know, but this one was very close to my heart because of that, you know, growing up playing it, shredding in my bedroom on the guitar, and then...
Probably better than the original,
over
I'm
to
assuming.
The Celtic. It was just a... Well, I was thinking that when I looked up the Romany and Dave Gilmour, you know, it was like doing Celtic music now, and it's like, oh, I wonder, did they happen to hear Celtic Pink Floyd and get a little inspiration, maybe, you know?
Yeah. Well, Pat, you might be able to find out. You're closer.
Yeah, that's right. You
know, connections, 6 degrees.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, yeah, yeah.
You got a better chance.
Yeah, I had, but I used to work for the music producer Bob Ezrin. Mm. Back in LA, so he produced Peter Gabriel, he produced The Wall, you know, he produced like all Alice Cooper's records, all Kiss's records, as far as I know, like just this massive music producer. So, but he was doing this computer gaming sort of edutainment, they were calling it at the time, CD-ROM games and stuff back when that was the thing. But so it was like Charlie Fleischer was one of the guys we'd see regularly, and Howie Mandel would come in. He had a little character that he was doing called Howie. Lil Howie. It was like this cute little voice kind of thing. But there was all these random people who come through. Quincy Jones came in. We were doing a game for him. The saxophone player, he was... played with Pink Floyd. His name's escaping me now. Scott Page.
There you go. I wouldn't have known his name if I'd seen him from all the concert videos. You know, like, oh, that's the saxophone guy. You know,
there's actually my favorite Pink Floyd live video is them playing live in Venice. In front of Mark Square with everybody out in gondolas and everything, and it's just amazing.
Is that the one where
it's
pulled in
my old boss playing the saxophone?
Your old boss, that's great.
He's like playing, he's there wailing on the sax.
You're like, yeah. Hey.
He's the guy, he had like a flat top, who was like party in the front, or what was it, business in the front, party in the back. He had the flat top haircut and then, like, you know, long hair down the back,
the mullet,
wailing on the sax.
Was the show in Venice one where they also pulled in a wine glass musician off the street to help do, like, I think maybe it was the opening of Comfortably Numb or something like that?
Be thinking of another show. It's been a while since I've seen it now. It might have been, But so I got to work for these people, and then Dave Gilmour's daughter Alice worked there one summer, so that was really nice to get to know her and just hear the inside stories of her family experience and stuff.
Well, there you go. So, if you ever run into any of them again, maybe just drop that question. Like, so how did Celtic Pink Floyd inspire you?
I mean, Brian and I joke. I mean, they have to be aware of it simply because, you know, we're paying.
Royalty deal or something like that, right?
But, I mean, it's, you know, granted, it's like $12 or whatever here and there. But how it breaks down, it's just, you know, We joke like, what are they spending our money on?
I was gonna say that's more than I'm getting.
Yeah. They bought a cup of coffee.
Right. Yeah. Wait, if you ever see me, you can ask, did you enjoy that cup of coffee? You're welcome.
Yeah.
Brian and Damon, between you guys, does it seem like, does one of you kind of tend to take the lead for arranging pieces for Celtic Pink Floyd, or is it kind of like always a group project, or maybe it's a mix?
I think it's a mix. I mean, I think maybe the first album, I took a little bit of the lead just simply because it was this really bizarre idea that I had. And just like, hey, I don't know if you're into this. And then, I would say, you know, subsequent, what we've been doing, like I said earlier about singles.
Yeah.
Like, so we did Murder. We did a version of Wexford Carol, which
I remember that. Yeah. And then, yeah. When that came out, that was awesome.
Did a version of Mad World,
yeah,
which was Tears for Fears. I think what happens is we'll pick a tune, collaborate on that, and then we'll just send demos back and forth a lot of those times. And like with Pat now, what we're talking about as a trio idea, and starting to play live again, we in effect have to rearrange everything.
Sure.
Obviously for, cause we're all kind of multi-instrument players. We want to pick and choose almost what's the point of the song, what's the arrangement, what's the core of the song. So is there a pipe, whistle, Bowron, you know, guitar, bass, keyboard, vocal, you know, all this fun stuff. So I'd say right now, currently, the three of us are probably acting as co-arrangers for this trio project.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's one of them that's out there already that I wanted to ask about, kind of like, who does what, because there was a part where and the worms ate into his brain. What song is that? Hey you. That's the one.
It's the worm.
That's the thing. There's a noise in there right after that line where I've always thought of, like, you know, it's like, I've always thought, like, oh, that's the worm noise. And if I'm not mistaken, Patrick, you do that on the Illen pipes. Does that sound right?
Oh, that's my specialty.
Is providing worm sounds. Like, as I'm trying to imagine, like, how would, you know, like, it works so well, how would you put this together? And I'm imagining, like, oh, you know, maybe Brian and Damon bounce some ideas back and forth between each other. They get kind of the idea rolling. And then maybe Patrick steps in and says, like, oh, well, you know what? I could do, in fact, if I remember right, that is the one where Dunmore Lasses comes in as, like, a trad piece, kind of, like, over Floyd in a way. And so, like, maybe Patrick comes in and says, I know a jig or a reel or something that could fit with this. That's... And what's more, look what I can do. You know, like, did I just describe exactly how it happened, or is it different than that?
Well, that's pretty much it. Yeah. Yeah, that's
very... that's giving more credit. I didn't know he was making a worm noise this whole time. So that's awesome.
You couldn't tell. Like you see that these things in your mind. It's like, you know.
Yeah. 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 When we were working on the first album, we kind of had three categories for each song.
Yeah.
One, we had like a clear idea of an arrangement, something specific we wanted to do. two, we had kind of an arrangement. And then the third is like, well, we'll just do a basic track and let the musicians, the soloists kind of run with it. So everything kind of fell on that. And obviously that was one where Pat just kind of took it and ran.
Yeah, kind of filled the spaces. Oh, it works really well. That's one of my favorite ones.
And we really wanted to get out of the way of folks too, because going back a bit to your earlier question about approaching arrangements, you know, either doing film work or commercial work or other bands, and kind of what Pat said, it's each project is so different. So, you know, you can bring in the positive stuff from other projects, but then you're not filtering it necessarily through those other projects. And in this case with the CPF, in 2011, when it started, in that first album, and Pat and everybody else who joined in, we really wanted to give everybody free rein and latitude to kind of just play whatever, and then we would kind of conform it within editing and post to kind of tweak and, like, here, you know, carve out a bit more of a you know, rock solo, so to speak, here and there. But yeah, it was phenomenal to see, hear, and watch. I mean, I was a fan in the you know, the studio, watching a lot of these people performing and listening to it. And I was like, oh my God, this is sounding better than I thought it would. So it was very, very fun.
Yeah, it's very much letting everybody shine.
Kind of shine on, like, know, a crazy diamond.
Exactly. Nice one. You took the bait. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but that's it. It's like, it's always the best thing in a studio when you have people who are great at their craft, and then you can just let them fly, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is a great spot to ask you about this sort of stripped down trio version of Celtic Pink Floyd, and kind of where you see it going, and what the intentions are for it, kind of first steps and stuff, and maybe we talk a little bit about this new track as well.
I think I'll jump in real quick and then you guys take over, but again, going back to the first album, 2011, we had hardly any promotion. This was kind of, you know, early-ish stages of Facebook, I guess, or whatever, but it was so grassroots. People were contacting us by, like, you know, internationally, like, what is this? Can you do this? Can you do that? Gigs, basically, like festivals. And we never had the opportunity to do it in that first album, simply because there's so many people involved.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, monetizing music and all that type of stuff now with streaming is obviously very difficult. So jumping ahead to now, the trio idea was simply a function of, let's see how it goes with three people. And just kind of reintroduce this type of music with this type of arrangement again, and keep it small. I mean, just, you know, it is what it is. We'll get by with this arrangement and then pick up other musicians if the money is there, you know, to be able to pay everybody. Because we have the travel lodge, you know, that fun stuff you have to worry
about. Yeah, of course, of course. Well, and like you mentioned earlier, too, but like, yeah, there are power trios in rock, and the trio is not an unknown thing in trad music either. So why not? Yeah, it seems like it'll fit.
Absolutely. We can make some of our arrangements big sound.
Some of our arrangements, like the, you know, brick and all that stuff, that are so thick. That's what it's challenging, yes, but at the same time, it's kind of fun to revisit. Like I said earlier, about, like, what's the point of the song? Meaning, what's the most important part of the song aside from the melody and lyric is the arrangement, because we have this limited resource now. We don't have seven people on stage like we had at some live shows before.
I've heard people talk before, like, about how limitations can actually be, like, really helpful for creativity. Like precisely having limited options is what kind of it'll bring forth creativity.
Absolutely.
I like how you keep talking about, like, what's the point of this song. It makes me think of, like I've heard people refer to melodies and chord progressions as having, like, landmarks, you know? Like, you can point to this thing and this thing and this thing. That's what makes it recognizable, you know? And it strikes me as, like, an interesting challenge that you have one like map or landscape of like a recognizable Pink Floyd song on one hand, and you got to be able to hang on to the elements that make that song what it is. And then you've got these elements of trad music and maybe even specific trad melodies on the other hand as well. And you're like laying these over, you know, and it's like, where can you find space for both to exist or make two of them happen at once and stuff like that? It seems like a really interesting challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's fun. Yeah. It's a musical challenge. And then at the same time, I think Brian, when we were selecting tracks for the first album and subsequent after that, it was... we didn't necessarily want to be repetitious either, in the sense of like, this is a jig, this is a reel, this is, you know, whatever, or have the bridge always be Celtic or the outro always
be Celtic, become formulaic
in the sense of that. Yeah. I mean, look, some of the stuff 100% dictates that. It's just, and especially like this new one we're, working on, and I guess we'll be out, here, soon. When we gave it to Pat, like he was kind of coming up with some really great guts for the middle.
Yeah.
Which
not worms gonna, this not time, worms. We're going for guts. Yeah.
But the jigs and whatnot like that, it's so that will inform, you know, how this one end, is ultimately mixed. And then as far as, so yeah, so we had our thoughts in our head of like, this is the song, this is the arrangement, and we give it to somebody else, in this case Pat, and it's like, oh, it's still the song and the arrangement we had in our head, but even better. And here's this new, there's this new part that we can explore with the mix. And so, and not to diminish any part of this process, but you know, thinking of it's one thing, obviously playing is one thing, and then this kind of post-production is this whole other animal of editing and selecting and who's muted, because everybody playing all at once all the time isn't the greatest sometimes for music.
Yeah, gotcha, totally.
All around.
you can speak to what it was like to, what your selection process was or figuring out process is. Like, you get the demo, you know, from Brian and Damon, and do you just sit down and listen to it a million times? Do you grab a whistle? You know, like, what's your method for figuring out, like, all right, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah, I usually start with a whistle. Even the low whistle or whatever whistle I have in that key, which is, you know, I've got just about every key of whistles. It looks like a pipe organ, in my little whistle case. You know, it's like from low D to high F, tiny little thing, or high G, actually. But so I had a C low whistle, or a G low whistle and a C high whistle. So I was playing with them, and then I ended up playing a C chanter, Illan Pipe chanter, Kohler and Quinn chanter that I have that's really beautiful. So I was able to play that on the piece and came up with a bit of a jig to go in the middle, kind of an E minor shape jig, what would be called an E minor shape on the Illan Pipes. So I was able to put that in the middle there, and I don't know what else. My recording method is like do everything all the time and then let the producer sort of take one note out of that bajillion notes and use that.
Thanks, Pat.
I know you haven't much going on. I knew you needed something to take up your time, you know.
I have nothing else to do.
Yeah, exactly. So
I like this note, but no, it's good. I mean, to speak to Pat's point also too, there's phrases and bars, and Brian and I were just talking the other night about it. The mix, like, we're like, oh, the high whistle part that Pat played at the end of the second chorus, there's like a really cool two bar motif. That would be nice to hear again. And I don't want Pat to redo it because it's, you know, free form and I want to kind of hear what comes out. But that type of thing, where we could kind of craft a bit of the song, it's, you know, the performer's still playing it, of course. Yeah. But, you know, even with guitar and bass, you know, for the Winter Marches On song, that was fretless. So I was having a ball doing fretless bass. Again, an homage to Sting and the Police. One of these instruments that I've always enjoyed playing. And that was, you know,
such a terrible sound.
Yeah, I mean, it worked fine, but I mean, it was terrible at first, in the sense of like, you can get too in your head with recording. So like, I have to be perfect. And actually, no, just play a bunch of wrong notes, get the feel first, get the point first. And then you can kind of go back and go, oh, okay, here's a better idea for this bit.
Yeah. Gotcha. And Brian, with most of these tracks, with your history being so like guitar forward, are most of the guitar solos we hear going to be coming from you? And also, do you guys divide the work between you for the post work, or do you have parts of it that each of you prefer to do? Like, you know, like, is Damon doing the first cut and then Brian, are you doing the final mix, or like, how does that work kind of get split up?
It kind of goes song by song, but for the most part, like, we'll get the final product and then Damon will master it because he's got all the mastering equipment. But just to kind of jump back to a point you brought up a while ago about how you come up with arrangement ideas. For a while, Damon and I were doing contract work for Coke, and
Coca-Cola, not cocaine.
Big cocaine came and talked to us.
And if anyone's listening.
and the way that would work is they would call up and they'd say, okay, we want you to do a commercial in the style of this artist. You have 2 hours to go.
2 hours?
And, well, it seemed like they would always call on a Sunday
and
night and say, we need this first thing tomorrow morning. Yeah.
Yeah. Classic corporate. Yeah.
They needed it on the plane.
Yeah.
So I drove to LAX at like 2 a.m. Anyways, go ahead, Bray.
But so I think in a lot of ways that really helped, because you're just like, okay, I got to focus. How can I arrange this to get a popular song that people know, an arrangement that it'll call to mind. And so I think that really helped with this project. But
I wonder if that Suzuki training helped you as well with that. If you can listen to an artist and be able to pretty quickly pick out what makes them identifiable, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I think it definitely helps, at least in the sense of like what Brian was saying earlier. Not that you can pick up any instrument and necessarily start sounding good or proficient, but you're not afraid of it. Because honestly, if you're 3 years old and somebody gives you a violin, I mean, you don't even know how to hold the thing. And, you know, you're making these terrible screechy cat noises, which everybody in the audience is applauding. But then obviously, you know, you kind of get your sea legs and you figure it out a bit more. But Brian, with the guitar stuff, let's go back to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where is your Eddie solos in Celtic Club?
I think a lot on this project, I wanted to step back and not do guitar solos on every song and again, let the other instrumentalists kind of shine. There's a couple songs. We did Fletcher Memorial Home.
Love that one.
And that one, I really wanted to do the solo close. I didn't play it exactly, but I wanted to do it close to honor what Dave did, because I always thought that was a great solo. And there was a few other things, but for the most part, we kind of wanted to sacrifice guitar solos for more Celtic solos.
So that's where you hear more fiddles and Nylon pipes and stuff like that.
Yeah,
gotcha. Right. Exactly.
Was a good point, Bri, too, because different versions and different performers we've had over the years, that's kind of a tenet. Like, we don't want to have any restrictions, but at the same time, the one of the cardinal rules, if you want to call it that, is we're not a Pink Floyd cover band.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, there's people that do that are brilliant. This is just a version of their music.
Gotcha.
So
that makes sense.
We absolutely wanted to, we just wanted to step back from, hitting the nail on the head too much. That's
You know, I think that a lot of people have said before, so I don't think anybody, in fact, I think some of the members of Nine Inch Nail might've even said this. So I don't think it'd be at all controversial to point out that I think a lot of us feel like Johnny Cash's take on Hurt is even better than the original. Like, dare I say, you know, so it doesn't mean that the original's not good, but like, whoa. I'm going to go out on a limb and risk hate mail and say that I might say I like you guys' take on Brain Damage even more than the original. And I love Brain Damage already.
Mission accomplished.
You know, but
break out the cigars, boys.
All right. But like, to the point of like not being a cover band, right? Which like you say, there's nothing wrong with being a cover band. Cover bands are awesome. Australian Floyd comes through Utah, and I've seen their show several times. It's excellent, you know, so
totally
good. Mm-hmm. And so being a cover band is great, but like, there's something different about this. And I don't mean to say like there are other musicians out there that do things where they like Celtify existing music. And I don't mean to say that that's necessarily bad or wrong either. But like, there's a kind of hacky way that you could go about that, where you basically just do exactly the original on a penny whistle, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that, like, you guys are carving out this space where like what you're making is something different that's obviously pulling from these other things. But Brain Damage in particular stood out to me as like, maybe I thought maybe it had to do with like maybe the beginning, you know, there's talking about being on the grass and having daisy chains and stuff like that, and like maybe part of it is that seemed to work so well with like more folksy instrumentation. Maybe that was part of it.
Right.
But I don't know. I just love that track.
Well, thank you.
Lunatic is on the grass. Lunatic is on the grass. Remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. Is in the hall.
chicks are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor, and every day the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open many years too soon, and if there is no room upon the hill, and if your head explodes with dark forebodings too, see you on the dark side of the moon.
And that, I think, Brian, you took the lead on that song a bit more.
Yeah.
And that one, and my only funny story with that was the idiocy of me typing this in to see maybe, and it goes out on iTunes and all this stuff back in the day. It swapped it. So for a long time, it said Brian the Damage. It was not a Freudian slip or anything. It was, it was like, oh my God, it's like that now globally.
We're just
going
to you can just pretend like you meant to. Yeah, Brian took the lead on it. So we thought we'd call it Brian Damage.
Did you say Floydian slip?
Yeah,
there
Floydian
for a
slip.
Yes, I did. Exactly.
Exactly. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good.
Or I wish I said it.
Well, I just, in general, I think as a musician, or at least I find myself going through this, that you're kind of struggling with, you know, wanting to create something original versus playing other people's music. But in this case, we're changing it enough that it feels like we're creating something unique. So,
yeah,
you know, I feel it's I don't want to say more important, but it's different than just being a cover band and going out and sounding exactly like the original artist.
Sure. So, on the one hand, maybe your goal is to sound exactly like the original. If you do that well, that's impressive. But this scratches a different itch. Like, this feels a different, it's a different thing. Yeah.
Right.
Gotcha.
But getting back to Brain Damage, I think I was just trying to think, you know, approach it more like a stripped down acoustic sounding. And I think what was it that you brought in that really pulled it together, Damon? Was that the, it wasn't the vibes. What was the instrument that you brought in that really kind of brought it to life?
Dulcimer? Maybe?
Dulcimer, that's what it was.
Yeah.
It was coming along well, and then Damon had the idea to throw a dulcimer in there, and it just kind of took it to a whole new level. I think that really changed the shape of the song.
And having all of these, this palette of folk music, not just Celtic, yeah, dulcimer. I mean, not that, you know, that's not in cult music.
These terms, right? We make up these terms to define things, but yeah, edges are rarely actually hard. Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yep. Yeah. So it was fun having all of this stuff. It's like a playground, and it felt like a lovely culmination of all of our musical histories kind of coming together. Where, you know, there's no ego here. It's just let's see what tune we like to play. And. And again, there was no really promotion back in 2011. I would say, I think we're on the radio somewhere. I don't know. There was bits and pieces, but arguably because the first album was released on St. Patrick's Day in 2011. And so that's been kind of a bit of a tradition for us, if we can, is to try to release something at least on Patrick's Day.
Well, that's what we'll aim for with this episode. This will be kind of the St. Patrick's Day episode. And so that'll be...
Absolutely.
In keeping with the tradition. I was trying to think, like, well, how did I come across the project, the music? And I think it might have just been algorithmic for me, actually. I think it was just a streaming platform that, you know, could see that I listened to a lot of trad music and I listened to a lot of Pink Floyd. And, it, you know, you might like this.
Oh, nice.
And they were right. The algorithm worked.
Finally, the algorithm. Yeah, finally it did something.
Did something
positive.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
There is another track that I wanted to ask you specifically about because I've listened to it over and over again, trying to figure out what the monster voice is saying in One of These Days. What is that?
Thank you.
cat actually said.
And remember, it was before the days of Google Translate, so it was a...
Was it like Irish Gaelic or something like that? I'm sitting there, I'm like, I started going like, I don't think this is English. I think that's, I'm trying to understand it, and maybe I'm never going to, you know?
It's cat speaking English.
Yeah, right. That was a very late night in the studio, yeah. Kind of thing. But that's what happens to people once they're in the studio past midnight.
That they turn into
they
that.
Just end up speaking Irish all of a sudden, yeah. You know. But but that was, it's just the translation from the directly from.
Well, we had the English. Mm-hmm. The English version was originally in the tune, yeah. And then you know. Mm-hmm. Two seconds later, it's like, hey,
wouldn't it be cool? Yeah.
Is it the one of these days?
Yes, that voice. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. Mystery solved, Dan. I'm glad to know.
Ain't law one. Yeah, one of these days. Yeah. Ain't law one.
Yeah. Yeah, and I should be careful, too. I don't want to be dismissive. Is it even appropriate to refer to the Irish language as Irish Gaelic? Is it a flavor of Gaelic? Maybe that's wrong of me to say.
No, it's Gaelic is the culture and Gaelga is the language.
Gotcha.
So yeah, everybody calls it Gaelic. It's like saying Oriental.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
But it's, yeah,
which I also
Ireland
don't want to mess
that
up either.
So.
You know, so
yeah, yeah. But that's the thing. It's like it's very few people if you really know that. Mm, you know. But it's like Gaelga is considered the language. Yeah.
Well, you know, and so, some of these like. You know, when I hear like, you know, jigs and reels that I'm used to hearing on the flute or the penny whistle or something like that, you know, like that's a lot of fun. I feel like there's other callbacks too, maybe more specific, and maybe this isn't intentional, but maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree, but I felt like Shine On You Crazy Diamond was fun because it didn't just do the kind of like the trad side of my brain and the Pink Floyd side of my brain are talking together. That's fun. It didn't just do that. It made me think of Riverdance as well, which is kind of like a little pocket of its own thing too, you know?
Riverdance takes up a lot of space in the collective memory kind of thing, you know. But it's like that if it wasn't for Riverdance, we mightn't even be here, and in a way kind of thing, you know, because it just put Celtic music onto the map for so many people. And the instruments, you know, as well, like especially the Illan pipes, everything changed overnight for Illan pipe. Illan pipe makers, lives changed that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, coming from the Highland piping side of things, I know that a lot of people in that community talk about what a great harvest time it was after Mel Gibson's movie came out, Braveheart.
Well, exactly.
You know, like
and
everybody wanted
the
to
uproar.
Learn. Well, yeah,
well, they all happened around the same time as well. You know, well, the uproar I was going to say from the Highland piping community, where it's like. You see
Highland
all these
pipes.
Highland pipers on the hill, but you hear like
Illan
pipes.
What an atrocity.
It's like, what in the world?
Thank goodness the Illan pipe is so easy to learn.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Start handing those out to kids in elementary school.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just make it look difficult. That's it. Yeah.
That's right.
And sound difficult. But the, but all those things happened around the same time. Like there was the Rob Roy movie as well.
Yeah.
Don't forget.
Rob Roy,
Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah.
Remember
That's still a hot tune on these instruments.
Most beautiful piece of music. Yeah. That Rob Roy. Titanic, you know, as well. Yeah. Just a couple of years later, Riverdance. There was like this little knockout punch kind of thing. So it was great, you know, and it's still going, you know.
Yeah.
So we need the next thing. Well, Sinners, that was the next one. Now everybody wants to hear Rocky Road to Dublin now because of that movie Sinners.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is great. You know, it's like, that's wonderful. Bringing more people to it. And also the TV show Bluey. So people with little kids, they're all the kids are hearing John Ryan's polka when the fairies come out. I've learned this from playing in schools and stuff, you know. So all the kids want to hear John Ryan's polka. Da 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 ba da ba da 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 da. It's like, holy smokes, that's what they play on the show, you know.
So that's great.
All these kids will grow up, you know, associating that with fairies. Yeah. So that's my goal as well.
Oh, you want to know what I sat my kids down in front of so that I could come and do this interview? They're watching Bluey now. Come
on. Yeah, right. Exactly. They're out there doing
dancing
jigs
to the fairy polka. That's a polka. Minute.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But it's funny that it's like we rely on these sort of mass media to be
the gateway.
But I suppose
drug
it is mass media. It's like it's hitting a lot of eyes and ears. So it's good. It's good for us, I think.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that, like, for me personally, not to like make it too serious or anything like that, you know, but like genuinely just you guys's observation and then playing out these ideas that, like, of the folkiness that is in rock and roll, et cetera. Right. Like, it's something that I don't think I ever would have observed for myself, and like having somebody else articulate it and then prove it. I listen to music differently, you know, because of this, because of having thought about that and listened to the Celtic Pink Floyd project. And I appreciate that. Like, that's really beneficial to me personally. I like it a lot.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
Yeah, thanks.
I'll send you my address. You can stick the check in.
You bet. Yeah.
I think it's the other way. I think we owe him.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, 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 hey.
You got it. Well, I think, too, if we're kind of wrapping up here a little bit, one of the things quickly with folk music, and then Pat just kind of touched on it, there's a cinematic quality, too. So I had, you know, kind of a film scoring background as well. So approaching these songs, it's not like this is folk, this is cinema. It's just listening to it enough and hearing what everybody's doing. So Shine and some other tunes might have more of a cinematic feel. I think simply because of that, but it's an amazing thing. Just who, what project brings in the people you meet, and you finding us, and we're really excited about doing a trio live, and you know, there's some other people that still want to join in the fun, so it might expand past the trio at some point, but we kind of want to test the waters, probably in and around Pat's neck of the woods first. Mm-hmm.
I live in the Nashville area.
Great place for music.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and there's lots of places to play and everything, so we can have a fun time.
They'll throw barbecue at us,
and that'll be fine. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
just you get a free meal.
Oh no, brisket.
Yeah. Oh, we're terrible.
Yeah. I think really the testament to this project lasting so long is just the amazing musicians that were open to taking a chance and be involved in the project, and that just kind of pushed it way beyond what we had ever imagined. So we're so fortunate that all these people were on board with it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, speaking of taking a chance, I don't mean to like in any way climb inside your head. Not that I would expect you to take what I say as something to make you nervous about or anything like that. But if we head toward Comfortably Numb to kind of finish us up, I don't think it's just me that like that song is like evergreen and always going to be like maybe the best song I've ever heard in my life, you know. That guitar solo that you don't want it to end, right? Like it could just go on and you'd be fine with it, right? And so in a way, I'm not going to say like I was like judgy going into listening to it the first time or like nervous about it, but there's a part of me that was definitely kind of like, come on, like how can anyone dare to even approach this one, you know, like in particular. But I thought you guys pulled it off beautifully. It was excellent, and especially like the weaving of what feel, I don't know if it's an identifiable trad melody that's going on there or if it's like more like motifs that feel like they fit really well, but that with the guitar solo at the end and stuff like that, it just I thought it was really well done. I just really like it. Bravo.
Yeah, well, Imagine how we felt doing it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but we did. I never felt that way, you know, as there was pressure. Yeah. It was more just like always felt like it was a tribute.
Yeah.
You know.
But to your point, I mean, you're right. There are these kind of, not sacred, but, you know, these tunes where it's like, how dare you this and how dare you that. Yeah, I get that. But at the same time, if it's terrible, hopefully we're not going to release
right.
it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so we have a bunch of musicians that are, you know, apt at what they do, all signing off on it and saying, yeah, wow, that was kind of fun. And it kind of brings this different take, basically, to it. So, yeah, absolutely no replacements whatsoever. It's just our version of what we hear.